This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, September 23rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
Here's the simple truth. For a long time, this economy has worked great for those at the very top. While ordinary, hardworking Americans, the people who built this country, have been basically cut out of the deal. And I've said this from the time I announced I was going to run. I believe this is a moment of potentially great change. This is our moment to deal working people back into the economy. This is our moment to prove the American people that their government works for them, not just for the big corporations and those at the very top.
As President Biden said, since before he was elected, he has described the upheaval caused by the coronavirus pandemic as an opportunity to reform the American economy. Now, after months of negotiations, Biden's trillion-dollar infrastructure plan will soon come up for a vote in the House. And Democrats are expecting to pass an enormous social safety net package through budget reconciliation. Both bills have been met with some resistance from Republicans. And there's another moment of political and economic reckoning quickly approaching. The federal government will soon reach the dreaded debt ceiling, and a government shutdown could occur as soon as next week if a stopgap funding bill isn't passed. John Cassidy, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss how the U.S. economy has fared in recent months with the pandemic raging again, and what these budget and funding bills mean for the Biden administration and for the economic health of the nation. Hi, John. I will admit to being flummoxed by much of this, and I always count on you for clarity and calm in these moments of economic crisis. So let's just jump in. The summer was really far more difficult than many of us expected. We thought that mass vaccination was going to encourage people to return to their workplaces and help boost the economy. But the vaccination rates have flagged, and the spread of the Delta variant has changed this calculus for many people in terms of consumer spending, jobs, eating out, and travel. Tell us a little bit about what you make of all of this.
Well, I think it is largely a story of the Delta variant, Dorothy. If you go back to the early summer, as you said, there was a great deal of optimism, in retrospect, over-optimism about how things would go. Economists were forecasting job growth of 1 million per month in late summer. And actually, we've just seen, well, no, last week, where we saw the August job figures, and, you know, they come in at just over 200,000. So there's been a big slowdown in hiring relative to what people thought would happen. And if you look at around the country where the jobs have been created, where they haven't been created, or across sectors, you know, healthcare versus hotels and leisure, for example, you see that the hiring patterns are very much reflect the spread of the variant, and the big slowdown is in sort of public-facing jobs like hotels and restaurants and leisure facilities. So I think it's pretty clear. Almost everybody would agree that this is a Delta variant story, the economic slowdown.
And this is the reason, or one of the main reasons, for the volatility of the stock market, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, the stock market is priced for perfection, basically, at this stage. We had an enormous rebound in the stock market since the big fall in March 2020. And on almost any metric you look at, price to earnings, price to dividends, whatever metric you use, stocks are very, very highly valued. It's actually been a bit of a surprise to me that we haven't had more volatility in the market and a bigger correction. The stock prices are still very high. We saw an 800 point drop in the Dow this week, but relative to a market that's standing at nearly 35,000, it's pretty trivial. It was only a fall of about 2.5%, and it rebounded in the couple of days afterwards. So the market's still very high. That's not the problem. People who've got equities and real estate have done very well out of the pandemic because the house prices have gone up, stock prices have gone up. The wealthy have done very well. That takes us back to the Biden story that, you know, the fruits of economic growth these days are very unevenly distributed.
Yeah, and he too was taken a little by surprise by the summer, the Delta variant and the rest. And he has responded quite dramatically by instituting a vaccine mandate for all federal workers and by requiring all businesses with 100 employees or more to require the their workers to be vaccinated or to submit to weekly testing. So this policy, as I understand it, is more sweeping than any previous vaccine requirement. And I was interested in a piece this weekend by David Oshinsky in the Wall Street Journal, who pointed out that the furious debates over mandated vaccines, which are essentially arguments over the balance between public health and individual liberty, go all the way back to the American Revolution, when George Washington had all of his troops immunized against smallpox. Also, Biden's new measures, as dramatic as they are, don't make vaccines compulsory in all cases. Do you think he's taken the right approach politically and economically?
Well, politically, I think there was an error in basically, you know, like everybody else, the White House fell for this story that the vaccines were going to cure everything. And they were, you know, they declared the sort of, if you remember going back to July 4th, they were basically declaring victory over the virus, which I, even at the time, I thought was dangerous, because if you looked at what was happening in India, and it was already starting to happen in the UK, it was already pretty clear that this variant was virulent. Now, the White House, you can understand why they did it. Biden was elected on the promise of defeating the virus. And, you know, one of the main reasons he won was because Trump was so incompetent in dealing with it. So politically, you can perfectly understand what happened. But it put them in an awkward situation when the fourth wave did arrive. And I'm a big supporter of the vaccine mandate. I mean, the economic arguments are so strong that they barely need rehearsing. I mean, most people are in favor of individual liberty up to the point where you harm other people. But in this case, there's a big, what economists would call, negative externality in not getting vaccinated. You're exercising your free will there, true, but in doing that, you put yourself at harm. Maybe you're allowed to do that. Self-harm is allowed. But you're also, putting other people at great harm, because you're likely to get the virus and spread it to other people. Economically and morally, I don't think there's a big argument here.
And politically, too, presumably, if we begin to see the infection rate dropping and economic spending and the rest, picking up again.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the polls, the public is supportive of vaccine mandates. 60-odd% of the population has got two vaccinations now, and they rightly feel that if they've got it, other people should go along too and be more civic-minded and more public-minded. So I don't think the vaccine mandate is going to do Biden any harm at all politically. What it does do is whip up the Republican base and add to the polarization, which is already intense because, of course, Trump and others on the right are using this to divert attention from anything else and just, whip up chaos.
Okay, and so now let's talk about Congress and the all-important bills I mentioned at the top of the program. First, tell us about the $3.5 trillion economic spending package, which is known as the Build Back Better bill, that Democrats hope to pass through budget reconciliation.
Right. Well, there's two spending packages here. I mean, I understand why people have sort of lost track of this, because it's, Bismarck used to compare making laws to making sausages and saying nobody wants to watch it. I understand if people have tuned out here. It is very complicated. Biden originally put forward the Build Back Better plan. It's been split in two since then. There's a now $1 trillion infrastructure package, which it has got some bipartisan support, although the Republicans who agreed to it are now getting hesitant. That's supposed to be voted on next week. The second bill is a much bigger one, as you mentioned, focused on the social safety net and on encouraging green energy, tackling global warming. That has got a price tag, or Bernie Sanders, who's the head of the Senate Budget Committee, put a price tag on that of $3.5 trillion. The Democrats are now arguing among themselves about what the actual figure will be. Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have said they won't support a bill that big. There's hesitancy among a few other Senate moderates and moderates in the House as well about supporting a bill that big. There seems to be irreconcilable differences, but they have to reconcile them, because the prospect of not passing any bill is so disastrous, I think. So the White House this week moved to get involved. Biden has invited all sides into the White House. He did that on Wednesday. No agreements came out of that, but what we've basically got going on now is a haggling process for the next week or couple of weeks as the Democrats struggle to agree on what's going to go into this reconciliation bill. The reason they're doing it through reconciliation is because they only need 51 votes to pass it through the Senate, and they've got that with the vice president. But they have to stay together. They can't afford to lose any votes in the Senate, and they can only afford to lose 3 votes in the House. So it's by no means a foregone conclusion that they will agree, but the consequences of not agreeing seem to me to be so unthinkable that I do think eventually they will come to some sort of agreement.
You wrote recently on NewYorker.com about some of the flaws in the Democrats' plan, about how they plan to pay for the spending package. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, well, there's, again, 2 spending packages. The infrastructure bill has already got some revenue raises in there, as they call them. That one is not particularly controversial. The controversy is over the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. The House Ways and Means Committee last week put out a plan to pay for that. Biden has said that this is not going to raise the deficit. So if they spend $3.5 trillion, they have to notionally at least come up with $3.5 trillion in revenues. This is over 10 years. Getting back to what the House Ways and Means Committee proposed, they've proposed what I would say is a fairly progressive plan, which is incorporates a lot of the ideas which Biden himself put forward, raising the top rate of income tax to 39.6%, which is where it was under Obama. They've got a new idea to include an additional tax surcharge on incomes of more than $5 million a year. They'd raise the capital gains tax from 20 to 25%. They would raise the corporate income tax rate from 21 to 26.5%. And they'd reform a whole lot of things that Trump did in the 2017 tax reform, where he favored a particular type of business partnership called pass-throughs, which, not coincidentally, are the sort of business partnerships that he and the Kushners and a lot of people in real estate and other investment type companies favor. The House Ways and Means Committee proposal would rein all that back. So that's all. I mean, that's all. I think progressive. And if you look at the overall distribution tables, which various Joint Committee on Taxation and various institutes have put forward, they do show that this plan, if it was put through, would increase the effective rate of income tax on people earning more than $1 million a year substantially by about 5 to 10% a year, and people at the very bottom would see a 10% fall. So it's a progressive proposal, there's no doubt about that. The big controversy about it is that even though it does target the rich, it's got a sort of get out of jail card for the very, very, very rich, the billionaires and the ultra billionaires, because they don't necessarily receive a lot of taxable income every year, because most of their money is tied up in wealth, in stocks and in real estate, etc. And as long as they just hold on to that and don't sell it or create any taxable income, they can just see their fortunes compound outside the tax system. Now, the way it's supposed to be taxed is at death through an estate tax, but the estate tax is completely riddled by holes and effectively doesn't work. Capital gains tax has been reduced to 20%, and even under the Democratic plan would only go up to 25%. So this is a plan which targets the rich, but sort of lets out the gazillionaires, lets them off the hook.
But why is that? I mean, this is what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, this is what vaulted them to the front of the presidential pack. And this is incredible, this idea of forcing the super, super rich to pay their fair share is very widely supported by the public. So why is that not in there?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think there are 2 possibilities. Number one, it is technically difficult to introduce a wealth tax. I mean, how would you go about it? I don't think the problems are insurmountable at all, but you would have to have a sort of annual audit of people's wealth, and then they would have to send checks to the IRS. Other countries which have tried it have run into some practical difficulties. So there are some practical difficulties about going along with the sort of Warren-Sanders program, although I actually support it and think it could be made to work, and even if it had some teething difficulties, it would be worth doing. But anyway, you can make a practical argument. The Biden administration didn't adopt a Warren-Sanders wealth tax. What they are doing is saying, okay, we won't tax wealth directly, but we'll close the loopholes and make the existing system more effective. they would get rid of a the biggest loophole of all is called the step-up in basis loophole, which basically means that you can pass on your fortune if you're Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or whoever, to your heirs without paying any money, any tax at all, on the capital gains you've made. And if you've owned Amazon since, you know, 2000, those capital gains, you know, could go into hundreds of billions of dollars and they would be tax-free. So the White House would eliminate or almost take big steps to restrict that loophole, which would have a big impact. And there's another loophole which is very popular on Wall Street among private equity barons and hedge fund barons, called the carried interest loophole, which, again, don't want to get into the, bore you with the technical details, but it allows them to disguise a lot of the income they get, regular income they get, as capital gains, which allows them to pay a lower rate. The White House has also proposed eliminating or restricting that loophole. The House Ways and Means Committee, for reasons which, again, must remain a mystery, didn't do either of those things. I mean, the suspicion, of course, is that they're responding to the lobbyists. They say that that's not true at all and that they make up for this by having the income surcharge on people who earn more than $5 million, which I mentioned earlier. But I think that's just relative to the size of these fortunes and the fact that a lot of them don't generate much taxable income. That's a sort of cop-out. So I think, you know, well, apart from the big question, apart from whether Democrats can actually agree on anything, is assuming they do agree on something, is how will the Senate modify the tax side of the plan to make it more progressive and, as you say, to tackle tax evasion among the gazillionaires? And there are some proposals on the table to do that, which we can talk about if you want.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So, unsurprisingly, congressional Republicans are maintaining an almost completely united front to derail the Democrats' agenda. And we know that Democrats are always a more fractious bunch, even when they have, as we've been discussing, the moral and political high ground, which they do here. And you mentioned earlier that some moderate Democrats, particularly Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, and some others, they have essentially been preventing their colleagues from completing and voting on the social spending bill. Some have even threatened to thwart both that bill and the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is supported by about 7 out of 10 voters, if they don't get a vote on infrastructure before the end of the month. So just tell us a little bit more about what's going on there.
Well, this is, you know, this is a classic Democratic Party internal split. As we all know, the Democratic Party is an extremely broad church, and the progressive wing of the party has been making the running, as you said, in the last few years, with Sanders and Warren sort of setting the intellectual agenda, which is reflected in the $3.5 trillion, the reconciliation bill. A number of moderates, including or moderate conservatives, whatever you want to call them, Manchin and Sinema in the Senate, but also maybe more significantly, a number of House members, are saying that this bill is too big. It'll allow the Republicans to tag them as tax and old-fashioned tax and spending Democrats, and they want the price tag to be brought down. So what we've got at the moment is a complete standoff between the two sides. It's a game of chicken. Both sides are effectively threatening to bring down what the other side wants. The progressives are saying that if the Democratic leaders don't put through the reconciliation bill first, or at least simultaneously with the with the infrastructure bill, they will vote down the infrastructure bill in the House. That would leave the Democratic leadership dependent on Republican votes, which may well not be forthcoming. So there's a possibility that the infrastructure bill could be voted down next week. If that happens, it's quite likely that the moderates who supported the infrastructure bill very strongly would turn around and say, well, we're not going to vote for the reconciliation package at all unless it's, you know, slashed. Manchin has talked about reducing it from 3.5 trillion to 1.5 trillion, which is obviously a huge cut. So the White House has seen the danger here and is now stepping in, and Biden himself is getting personally involved. It seems like what they need is a plan to simultaneously deal with both bills. I don't think they can, you know, reach an agreement on one without the other. There's going to have to be some sort of umbrella agreement with sort of headline figures that both sides can live with. And there were reports in the papers after the meeting at the White House that that's exactly what Biden had said to Manchin, saying, you know, come back to me with a number you can live with. So that's where we are at the moment.
So this week, the House passed a funding bill that would provide funding through December 3rd if the Senate goes along with it. If not, the federal government will shut down on October 1st. Democrats have also tacked on a request to suspend the debt ceiling through December 2022. Why is that so important?
Well, you know, this is another... I think I say this every time I come on the show. You know, the United States is sort of hamstrung by its own institutions here. You know, this crazy idea that we even need a debt limit. Other countries don't do it. That you have to, you know, there's an endemic budget deficit here now because we can't agree on how to balance the books. So the idea that you then have to go back every year or two to get another increase in the debt limit or the country will default is crazy. But anyway, here we are again. The Republicans, of course, are just using this as a cudgel to beat the Democrats with. I think the Democrats made a political error here in that they could have just included a debt limit increase in the reconciliation bill and pushed it through by themselves. They've got the political...
Yeah, that seems much smarter.
I don't know why they didn't do it. If you listen to people in Washington, they say there are two reasons. Politically, they think raising the debt limit's unpopular, so they wanted both, you know, to tag the Republicans with it too. I think most people on the street really don't understand or give a damn about the debt limit. But anyway, there were some political calculations there which have rebounded. And secondly, there are some technical issues with putting it through reconciliation in that it would apparently make it a bit more difficult to pass the reconciliation bill and a bit more involved and would take a bit longer. But I think the price you pay in terms of added complication is certainly worth it just to get this thing off the table.
So Republicans, and we've been here before too, of course, led by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, have vowed to block the entire funding bill, calling it a purely partisan spending binge. We have had government shutdowns before, quite regularly, in fact. And just to cite one, during the Bill Clinton administration, there were actually two shutdowns when he faced off against House Speaker Newt Gingrich over some of the same issues at stake today, funding for education, the environment, and public health. But didn't those actually help Clinton with voters?
Yeah, I mean, I think the government shutdowns is in a different category to a debt default. I mean, so there may be people in the White House who think they can turn a government shutdown to their advantage, and that may well be the case, especially since a government shutdown in this case would mean that a lot of the relief programs which are working to offset some of the pandemic would be put under threat. So if the White House could, turn political responsibility for a shutdown to the Republicans, that sure could help them in next year's midterms, conceivably. The Republicans, I think, are working on the assumption that anything which is sort of looks like chaos in Washington, gridlock, rebounds against the incumbents, and may also, you know, if they can, they've got an interest in just derailing you know, everything, I think. They're clearly just want the Biden presidency to look like a failure going into the midterms. And this is all part of the same strategy. Whether McConnell ultimately, if it came to sort of 24 hours before a debt default, would agree to raise the debt limit, I think is another question. But at this stage, and in terms of just a shutdown rather than a full-on debt default, I think he will, you know, he's willing to play hardball all the way.
And stepping back from all of this just a little bit, how are the two parties faring with voters, and how important is this moment for the Biden presidency?
Well, as we all know, Biden's ratings have gone down over the summer quite considerably, whether that's a product of the Delta variant, whether it's a product of what happened in Afghanistan, or whether it's just the end of a presidential honeymoon, which we always get to some extent, is not clear. But, you know, for the first time, his ratings dipped under 50% during the whole Afghanistan crisis. And they rebound a bit, but not much. So, yes, this is a huge challenge for Biden, obviously. And as you said at the beginning of the show, he campaigned on the Build Back Better plan, the idea that the pandemic, as well as being a disaster, was an opportunity to sort of restructure America, as he said in the intro, to slant things back towards the workers and away from capital and the billionaires. And 6 months later, 9 months later, rather, here we are with his agenda basically coming down to these two bills being passed, particularly the reconciliation bill. So I don't think you can overstate the importance of getting something passed for Biden. It's absolutely essential.
Thanks so much, John. I do understand all of this much better now.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. It is very complicated, but ultimately, I think, you know, the voters will expect the president to, you know, to push through the agenda which he got elected on, and that's ultimately what it all comes down to.
John Cassidy, a New Yorker staff writer, is the author of two books on economics, including How Markets Fail: The Logic of Economic Calamities. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.